resounding, enthusiastic response. I like it. So tonight we're going to continue in our study of 1 Samuel in chapter 25 this week. So you can turn there if you would like. So I'll just kind of start with some reflections on verse 1, which says, "Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him at his home in Ramah." So if you remember back to chapter 16, Samuel, in addition to being one of the judges and a very prominent figure there in Israel, he's also the man who anointed David as the king to the throne of Israel. And so kind of as we look at this situation, the story that we're going to look at tonight, it's kind of helpful, I think, to consider potentially the emotional state of Israel as a nation in general at this time, and particularly David, not only because the man who sort of called him to the throne has died, but also the fact that it's probably that much more on his mind that he is the heir apparent to the throne as he addresses individuals and he goes forward here with the death of Samuel. And then so in the end of verse 1, it says, "Then David moved down into the desert of Moan," or Maon. "Certain man in Maon who had property there at Carmel was very wealthy. He had 1,000 goats and 3,000 sheep, which he was shearing in Carmel. His name was Nabal, and his wife's name was Abigail. She was an intelligent and beautiful woman, but her husband, a Calebite, was surly and mean in his dealings. While David was in the desert, he heard that Nabal was shearing sheep, so he sent 10 young men and said to them, 'Go up to Nabal at Carmel and greet him in my name. Say to him, long life to you, good health to you and your household, and good health to all that is yours. Now I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my young men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them." So in verses 2 through 8, we see David going after his men have protected Nabal's shepherds and their flock from all various sort of dangers. He sends his men to David and really with a humble posture. Here we have the heir apparent to the throne, the man who, especially at this time, is probably very conscious of the fact that he's the next king of Israel. And instead of going and saying, you know, it would be easy for him to go and say, "I come from David, give us your food. David's the king in waiting, the successor to the throne, and he demands that you give him payment for protecting your sheep and your shepherds." But instead of doing that, he sends them much more humbly. He sends them and even refers to them as Nabal's servants and to David as his son. So kind of being mindful of that humble posture with which they approach this situation in the beginning. And then picking back up in verse 9, "When David's men arrived, they gave Nabal this message in David's name. Then they waited. Nabal answered David's servants, 'Who is this David? Who is this son of Jesse? Many servants are breaking away from their masters these days. Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?' David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word. David said to his men, 'Put on your swords.' So they put on their swords, and David put on his. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with supplies. One of the servants told Nabal's wife, Abigail, 'David sent messengers from the desert to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were out in the field near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, they were a wall around us all the time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do, because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him." So when David's men come to Nabal, he insults David. He said, "Who is this David? I don't know who this David is. There's people coming to me left and right wanting food and water and drink. Should I just give it to anyone that comes to my doorstep?" And obviously, he would be aware who David is, that, you know, he's sort of pleading ignorance just for the sake of being insulting in this case. And so David is offended. David determines that he's going to go, him and his men are going to go, and they're going to kill Nabal and anyone else they can find likely. And so then one of Nabal's servants wisely goes to Nabal's wife and says, hey, you know, we're about to have a real problem here. You know, your husband, he's done some pretty bad things where this guy, he's going to come and he's going to make a real mess for us. So think about it and see what you can do for us. And Abigail, being wise, as it says at the beginning of the chapter, she takes a little message there and does something with it. So and picking back up in 18, says, Abigail lost no time. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisins, and 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on donkeys. Then she told her servants, go on ahead, I'll follow you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. There's a few things to kind of look at in that section there between 18 and 19, those two verses. The first thing is, if you notice the beginning, it says, Abigail lost no time. And some versions say Abigail made haste. And I think what we need to look at there is the sense of urgency. So when Nabal's insulted David and his men, and they know that David's likely going to come and seek retribution for that, Abigail says, well, we got to do something about this. And instead of sort of sitting back and making a plan and taking her time about it, she has a sense of urgency, right? And I think we need to take note of that in our own lives. And because when it comes to doing the right thing, there's no time like the present, right? Hank agrees. He says yeah to a lot of things, though. So when it comes to doing the right thing, there's no time like the present. And this reminds me of an instance where years ago, it was August of 2008, my dad had gone to pick up my mom from work in a less, not such a great part of town in Nashville. And he was waiting in the parking lot at the library, at the public library. And he had about 15 minutes before it's time to pick up my mom. And he was just sitting in his car, the windows down on a hot August day, just sort of getting things in order, that kind of thing. And he said, looking back, he remembers feeling like he needed to leave. He didn't really know why, but he just felt like he ought to leave. And then about 5 minutes later, when he looked to the left, out the left driver's side window, and realized that there were 3 men standing there in the parking lot, one of which had a gun to his head, demanding he leave, get out of the car right now and leave, he realized later that that was the Lord prompting him to leave, to do something to avoid danger. Luckily, everything turned out fine. They even were able to get his car back in like 30 minutes, and there was no harm, no foul as far as that goes. But there's a lot of times where that sort of thing pops up in our lives, where we either feel a prompting like that, or maybe someone comes to us and gives us sort of a word of admonition or you know, gives us some advice or that kind of thing, or we just know the right thing to do. And it's really easy to sit back and consider that, or to, you know, maybe even brush it off. But we really have to be mindful of where that prompting or that message is coming from, and waste no time, as Abigail did here, because as we find out later in the text, Abigail didn't have any way to know for sure that David and his men were on their way, David having sworn to kill every male in Nabal's household. And so that's why it's important, even though we can't see what's going on around the corner, we have to make sure and make haste when it comes to following God's prompting. And so we pick back up in verse 20 there. As she came riding her donkey into a mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. David had just said, it's been useless, all my watching over this fellow's property in the desert so that nothing of his was missing. He has paid me back evil for good. May God deal with David, be it ever so severely, if by morning I leave alive one male of all who belong to him. When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, my lord, let the blame be on me alone. Please let your servant speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. May my lord pay no attention to that wicked man, Nabal. He is just like his name. His name is fool, and folly goes with him. But as for me, your servant, I did not see the man my master sent. Now since the Lord has kept you, my master, from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, May your enemies and all who intend to harm my master be like Nabal. And let this gift, which your servant has brought to my master, be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's offense, for the Lord will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my master because he fights the Lord's battles. Let no wrongdoing be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you to take your life, the life of my master will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl away as from the pocket of a sling. When the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader over Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. And when the Lord has brought my master success, remember your servant. So Abigail meets David on the road, and Abigail says, you know, falls on her face and begs for mercy, not only for the ignorance of her husband, and she sort of throws him under the bus a little bit and says, he's a fool, he doesn't know what he's doing, he's wicked, but I'm not. Please, at least for my sake, have mercy on Nabal and his household. If for nothing else, you know, put the blame on me. But there's a little more to what she asks of him. It's not just the mercy she asks for her own sake or for her husband and his household. But if you look down in verse 30, when the Lord has done for my master every good thing he promised concerning him and has appointed him leader of Israel, my master will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed or of having avenged himself. So at this point, David has fallen into a bit of sin with his bloodthirsty need for revenge against Nabal for this offense. And Abigail has come and pled for mercy, but she's also sort of pled to David that, hey, when you ascend the throne, you want to be able to lay your head down at night and know that there's no needless blood on your hands. Your conscience can be clean, and you haven't come to this position through any sort of evil or sin nature. And I think that's important to look at. It's easy to kind of glance over that sometimes, but that's really the bulk of what Abigail's appealing to there is not just the mercy for herself, but also the conscience mercy for David, but also, you know, a soul thing for David, you know, making sure that he has his heart in the right place when he has his affairs in order there. And so picking back up in verse 32, David said to Abigail, "Please be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day and from avenging myself with my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not one male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak." Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought him and said, "Go home in peace. I have heard your words and granted your request." When Abigail went to Nabal, he was in the house holding a banquet like that of a king. So he refuses kindness to David, who has done well for him, protecting his shepherds and his sheep. And in the meantime, he's at the house partying with this big feast for all of his friends. He was in high spirits and very drunk, so she told him nothing until daybreak. Then in the morning, when Nabal was sober, his wife told him all these things, and his heart failed him, and he became like a stone. About 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Praise be to the Lord, who has upheld my cause against Nabal for treating me with contempt. He has kept his servant from doing wrong and has brought Nabal's wrongdoing down on his own head." Then David sent word to Abigail, asking her to become his wife. His servants went to Carmel and said to Abigail, "David has sent us to you to take you to become his wife." She bowed down with her face to the ground and said, "Here is your maidservant ready to serve you and wash the feet of my master's servants." Abigail quickly got on a donkey and, attended by her 5 maids, went with David's messengers and became his wife. David also had married Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they both were his wives. But Saul had given his daughter, Michal, David's wife, to Paltiel, son of Laish, who was from Gala. So again, we have David, the heir apparent to the throne, going out. He's protecting this rich man's sheep and shepherds, and he goes humbly and just asks for some food for payment for doing this good deed. And Nabal refuses him, and in the midst of that, insults him. And so David decides he's going to go kill Nabal, and luckily Abigail intervenes and appeals to his conscience in that area. So what do we do with this story? It's one thing to look back at these narratives and say, okay, this is what David did, what he could have done wrong, what he did do right, but there's not a lot of us standing along ridges protecting shepherds from danger these days, right? And there's not a lot of us waiting to be the king as soon as the current king dies and things like that going on in our lives. But there is still some application we can draw out of this story that I think is very, very critical. The first, again, is, you know, that we want to make sure that we have that sense of urgency that Abigail had. That's really important for us. But also, let's look back at David's response to Abigail. When he has been sinful and he has this bloodthirsty desire to revenge himself for this insult that he feels has been brought upon him, Abigail goes to him and tells him, if you do this, you're going to be wrong. This is needless bloodshed that doesn't have to be brought about to the world, and that's going to be wrong. And so when we look at David's response, he's thankful to her. He steps back, and instead of in that bloodthirsty rage, pushes her to the side and says, get out of my way. I've been offended. I'm the heir apparent to the throne. How dare anyone insult me, offend me, and bring against, you know, pretending like they don't know who I am. They know who I am. I'm going to go take matters into my own hands there. Instead of doing that, he steps back and he says, you know, you're right. If I had done this, I would have regretted it. That would have been sinful for me to do that. So why would it have been sinful for David to have done that? He is the king, or going to be the king. God has ordained him to be the king and going to be a better king than Saul. At this point, it's been obvious that Saul is a terrible king. So why would it be wrong for him to want to get his revenge? Well, part of it can be found in Deuteronomy 32:35, a text we're all probably fairly familiar with. Vengeance is mine and recompense for the time when their foot shall slip. For the day of their calamity is at hand and their doom comes swiftly. So it would have been sinful for David to have taken matters into his own hand and avenged this insult, because the Lord says that vengeance is his. It's not our place to seek out vengeance when we've been wronged or offended or insulted. That's God's place. When Nabal insulted David, not recognizing his kinship, he was insulting David, but more than that, he was insulting Yahweh. God had said, this is the king of Israel. And Nabal said, who is this guy? He was spitting in the face of God when he said that. He wasn't spitting in the face of David. It wasn't David that made David famous or worth knowing. It was God that made David worth knowing. So this is the reason we shouldn't take revenge when we've been wronged. Not just because God is more just than we are and can mete out justice in a more proper, holy way than we can without sin clouding our judgment. But more than that, we're insulted in the way that David was. When we're insulted in the way that David was, it's not us being insulted. It's God being insulted. When someone comes to us and offends us, or this morning when Brandon was talking about the persecution that's sure to follow faithful discipleship in Christ, it's not us that's being persecuted. It's Christ in us that's being persecuted. It's Christ in us that's being offended and insulted. So when someone comes after us, whether it's in these far-off places where people are being killed for being Christians, or where maybe it's someone at work doesn't want to sit next to you in the cafeteria because you might talk about Jesus, whatever it might be, maybe they exclude you because you don't want to go to that drinking party they're having, or that go to that sports bar to watch the game with them because you feel convicted not to. However big or small that persecution is, it's not you that's being persecuted, it's God that's being persecuted. And that's exactly why it's sinful to take vengeance into our own hands in those instances, because we're not the one that deserves to be avenged. It's God that deserves to be avenged, and he says that their time will come, and it's on him to make sure that happens. And who are we to take those matters into our own hands? And that's the other problem with what David wanted to do. If we look at this story, it'd be easy to say, hey, you know, if David had killed Nabal, that would have satisfied his need for revenge. It would have made him feel better, in the moment at least. And by the way Abigail talks about her husband, it's clear that she's not exactly thrilled about the marriage. You know, she's not a huge fan of his. And so it would be easy to look at her and say, you know, if she'd have just stepped aside on that road and let David and his men go and slaughter everybody in the house, she'd have been rid of him. That would have fixed her problem. She wouldn't have had to deal with Nabal anymore. And then, who knows, maybe she could have been gone to be David's wife. And the funny thing is, that's exactly what happens, only in God's time. When Abigail follows that prompting to do what's right, waste no time to do it, and prevents David from sinning and bringing, you know, guilty conscience to his throne, she prevents David from killing Nabal, which puts sin on David. And she prevents Nabal from being killed by David, so that keeps her married to Nabal. But in the end, 10 days later, God does that for them. So the reason we can't take matters into our own hands, no matter what it may be, is because we don't know what's around the corner. If we do something to get what we want and we don't do it God's way, it may be that we were going to get it or whatever it might be, but it's not going to be as glorious if it wasn't the way God wanted it to be. If we look at marriage, we look at sexual relations, it's one thing to go and have some sort of affair, be involved in some sort of nefarious relationship in that way, and the fleshly desires are met, but outside of the context of marriage, it's not the same. It's not the good that God designed it to be, in the same way that vengeance on Nabal would not have been the glorious way God designed it to be had David taken matters into his own hands and had Abigail allowed him to do so. So when we look at this story of David and Nabal and Abigail, we want to think back on the main points that when someone comes to us and presents our sin to us, the way Abigail had done to David in this chapter, it's really easy to want to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't know how it feels to be treated the way I've been treated. Or you don't know how it feels to be lacking monetarily all the time. And so when someone, you know, when we're tempted to take that money out of the drawer, or we're tempted to do something we know we ought not do, it'd be real easy to say, you don't know me. It'd be easy to say, you don't judge me. God's the judge of me. But what we have to look at is David's response is to step back and say, you're right. I repent of that sin. And I want to not get involved in that. So whether it's sin or taking matters into our own hands, we have to remember that God oftentimes will put a messenger in our way, just like he did with Abigail. And while it is tempting to power through and ignore that message, we have to remember that it's necessary to follow that message, because we don't know what the bigger picture is. I remember one time I used to enjoy horror movies a little bit, mostly sort of more psychological type thrillers, and there was a movie called The Strangers that came out years ago, and I remember wanting to watch it because it looked very psychologically interesting and that sort of thing, and so I said, I reserved it on Redbox, I was going to go rent it, and as soon as I hit reserve, I had that little small voice saying, you don't need to watch this movie, and I thought, well, you know, big deal. It's the middle of the day, and it's just fiction. So I drive to the red box and I pick it up, and the whole time, you don't need to watch this movie. You don't need to watch this movie. So I go home and I put it in. I'm ignoring that little voice. I put the movie in. I get about 15 minutes in. Nothing really all that scary has happened. But that voice was so overwhelming that I couldn't make myself watch the rest of that movie. And I firmly believe that that was God preventing me from seeing something I didn't need to see. Who knows what it was? To this day, I have no clue what it was God was wanting to keep me from seeing. But he clearly wanted me to not watch that movie for whatever reason. And what we have to do is, even though we don't understand why God's preventing us from doing something, whatever it might feel like it's right to do, we have to step back and say, God is Lord, and I need to do what he says. I need to follow his promptings. We never know what's around the corner in our lives, and we have to have faith that whatever God has for us is best. When that messenger comes to us, whether it's an Abigail or that still small voice whispering in our ears, we have to remember that God's will is best. What he asks for us is going to be best. And now sometimes it's easy to get that worldly opinion or that worldly standard of what's best. For some of us, as Brandon mentioned this morning again, you know, for some of us, it might be easy to say health and wealth is best, right? It would be best if I had a really nice truck outside. It'd be best if we had a really big house and if I had really expensive guitars. That would be best to my standard. But when we say that whatever God has for us is going to be best, and that's why it's crucial we listen to his prompting, listen to his messengers, we have to remember that best doesn't necessarily look like what we think it looks like, but it is going to be best. Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for tonight. We thank you for the message that you have for us this evening. And we just pray that from here forward, you'll help us remember to listen to those messages that you put in our way and to remember that your will for us is what is best for us, even if we don't understand it sometimes. And that we really need to listen to those voices. We need to listen to the people in our lives that love us, that care for us, and want good for us. And just teach us to trust you and not take matters into our own hands. No matter how big or small the situation is, just allow us to have faith in your will. Amen. And you're dismissed.